Hello, everybody. This is Brent Johnson with Milkshakes, Markets, and Madness. This is a show where we talk about milkshakes, which is related to the dollar milkshake theory, where we talk about the markets, although, of course, you know, we're always talking about financial markets, investments, what's going on in the world. And then the madness always happens when we see something crazy going on in the world. And if you've been with us from the beginning, and you've been watching us for a while, you'll know that very, very rarely, as in never, am I the one that intros the show. In fact, we've always had my good friend John, who would intro the show, and then we would start talking. Well, it turns out we've had a little bit of a madness this week, because John called me a couple days ago and said that he had decided that he was going to step away from Milkshakes, Markets, and Madness, as well as The Macro Alchemist. And I got to be really honest, I'm just very, very surprised and very sad. John is just such a fantastic guy, super smart. He did an incredible amount of work on the show over the last couple of years that I am incredibly grateful to him for doing. And I'm not exactly sure yet what he's going to do next, but I can tell you whatever it is, he will be very successful at it. And I wish him nothing but the best. And you know, John, if you're listening, maybe you come back someday. And if you ever decide you want to, we're here and we would love to have you back. So in the meantime, I've got to figure out how to do all the stuff that John did. And, you know, I probably can figure it out, but it's going to be an adventure. So here we are. We're trying to figure this out. So you get to come on this adventure with me of how we do all the back end stuff that John did such an amazing job of. But what I thought we would start doing today, something that we haven't really done before, but what I thought we would do is we would look at some slides and we would refer back to a show we did a couple weeks ago when I talked about, you know, John had mentioned earlier in the spring that we were kind of in the middle of the milkshake, you know, despite everybody's protestations, you know, high rates in the U.S. were pulling capital into the markets in the U.S., it was pushing assets higher. And despite everybody thinking that high rates would be bad for the markets, it was actually that was helping, you know, do the whole milkshake theory that said high rates and government spending would contribute to a booming market. And that's really what we saw. And my comment was that that could go on for a long time. And so what we've always said is we didn't think people should just be on the sidelines. We don't think people should just be sitting in cash doing nothing. We do think everybody should have exposure to equities, but we also said you got to have some kind of protection on the downside. You shouldn't just be long equities with no kind of protection. Again, whether it's some cash, whether it's puts, whether it's some other kind of hedges, we always felt it's important to have, an eye on the exit in case things go bad. And one of the points that we had made was that we weren't net short. We didn't think that everybody should be, you know, shorting the market, but just be ready. But then a couple of weeks ago, you know, John made that point again, but I said, that is true. But at this point, I'm probably as hedged as I've ever been and neutral at best, and maybe even a little bit net short considering the amount of hedges that we had. And so I thought, you know, rather than just telling you that's what I did, I'd kind of go back and I'd show you by looking at some slides kind of what contributed to that. Rather than just saying, you know, it's important to have some hedges, why I felt more comfortable, you know, having more hedges than I typically would. So I thought what I would do is walk through some of the signals that I look at. And so one of the first ones I always look at is the relative strength and the stochastics of different markets. So what I'm showing here is the RSI and the stochastics of the SPY, which is basically the ETF on the broad S&P 500. And what you'll see, now this is a one-year chart and it's a daily chart. What you'll see is back here around June 14th, 15th, 16th, is the market was at its high. But then if you come down here and you look at the relative strength was as high as it's been in the last year, and it was above 80, and it was headed higher, and the stochastics, which is just another way to measure market strength, was in very close to 100, which it can't go higher than 100. And so my point, and if a number of different sentiment gauges that you look at, whether it's daily sentiment, whether it's sentiment trader, whether it's a number, you know, any sentiment indicator that you looked at back in the middle of July was basically just off the charts bullish. And so oftentimes when you get that level, you just know that you're due for a pullback. Now, I know there's some people saying, yeah, Brent, but this is just, you know, just because that happens doesn't mean there's going to be a crash. And that is absolutely true. Just because you have high relative strength, just because you're at an all-time high, just because the stochastics are high, doesn't guarantee a crash. But what it does mean is that you're probably going to get a pullback because those indicators just can't really go much higher. And so I'll show you what I mean. If you go to the, if I go to the next slide, which is the weekly of going back 5 years, we can go back and look historically and see how this is done. So again, right before COVID, markets were at its high. The RSI was above, you know, 75. It was up in the 80 range. You can see it's getting extreme. And same with the stochastics. And then sure enough, we had a sharp pull down. That was the COVID. And then we came out of it. And then here's again, if we look kind of in late 2021, at the very beginning of 2023, again, we saw markets are at their highs. The RSI didn't get quite as high as it did back right before COVID, but it was getting in extreme territory again. The stochastics had already kind of started to roll over. And then sure enough, we get a drawdown over the next 6 months. Then we come up again. And then, you know, we look at the earlier this year in 2024, back in April, you know, we got back as high as any point as we'd been in 5 years on the RSI. We got back to as high as any point we'd been on the stochastics. And this, again, sentiment was off the charts. And sure enough, we got a very short pullback. Now, it didn't last very long. And you can see we got this hard bounce. So then here we are at the beginning of, in the middle of July. Markets are at their all-time highs. Stochastics are as high as they've been. Relative strength is as high as it's been. And again, sentiment is just off the charts. Now, what I've looked at so far is the SPY, which is the broad market. But if we were to look at the technology stocks, because largely the NASDAQ, the Mag 7, that's where the real sentiment has been. And again, you look both in April and again in the early part of July, relative strength is as high as any point as it's been in the last year, as well as the stochastics. And if we look at the last 5 years, again, relative strength is as high as any point of the last 5 years. The last time, every time it had gotten to this high before, we get a pullback right there. We get a pullback right there. We got a pullback right there. And again, we get a pullback there. And again, the stochastics were high as well. And we had, you know, sentiment readings were just off the charts. If we go to the even a smaller subset of technology, now let's look at the semiconductor. So this is SMH. This is the semiconductor ETF. Again, this is a weekly chart and it's a daily thing. But if you look back at the last year, it was in late June. The stochastics were as high as any point they'd been in the last 5 years. The relative strength was as high as any point in the last 5 years. And if we go back the other times that we had these peaks in the RSI and the stochastics, we got a pullback. We go, you know, back here when we had these peaks, we got a pullback. Now, again, we're not getting crashes, but we're getting at least a pullback, mainly because it just couldn't go higher in the short term. And so, you know, then we kind of got back to the same level. We got back to the all-time high again in the middle of July. We didn't quite get back the same level of relative strength as we were in April. But again, very high. And the stochastics were coming up again. And then, this is the weekly. I think I was talking about the daily there. But this, if we go back and we look, every time we got these really high readings, we would get a pullback, right? Then the other thing I look at was the put call ratio. Now this right here is at the beginning of July, this point down here. Now that point is lower than at any point since 2021. And if we move 2020 and 2021, which is when we had the kind of the craziness from COVID, the point that we were at on the put call ratio in early July was as low as any point in the last 10 years. If we take out the late 2020, 2021 period. So again, any of these indicators on their own, you don't necessarily put a trade on. But when they start to add up, then you start saying, okay, well, maybe that's something else. Again, you got to remember sentiment was off the charts. Then the other thing that was going on at that point, now this one's going to get a laugh, I promise you. as we had Mercury going into retrograde. And I know there's people out there saying, oh my God, this is the madness part of the episode because Brent is talking about astrology. But the thing is historically, when Mercury goes into retrograde, and I'll let you guys look up what Mercury going into retrograde actually means. You just go on Google and look it up. Bad things often happen. Now, the red areas are the Mercury in retrograde, but a lot of people will talk about Mercury in retrograde, which is typically a 3 or 4 week period, but there's also a 2 week period preceding it and a 2 week period on the end of it. And that is, I have seen that historically those often will have events as well. So for those of you thinking that I'm totally out of my mind, let me give you a couple of examples. The 1929 stock market crash. It wasn't perfectly in retrograde. It was very close. It didn't coincide directly, but it did happen in that shadow period that I was just talking about. And again, if I go back to this slide, you know, at the beginning, July 17th is when this shadow period started. Now, again, other people are saying Brent's lost his mind. Black Monday, 1987, Mercury goes into retrograde, and the crash occurred during Mercury, the retrograde period. Okay. 2008 financial crisis, September 29th, 2008, major crash day. Well, just a week before, Mercury had gone into retrograde. So the crash occurred during the Mercury retrograde period. Listen, I know people are saying he's crazy, but listen, this on its own, it doesn't mean anything. But when you start adding everything up, you know, it's just another indicator. Again, let's look at what happened in 2020, February 20th to March 23rd. That was Mercury going into retrograde. Now, what happened from February 20th to March 23rd? Again, the crash began right during that period. So now think about this. We have markets at their all-time highs. We have RSIs at their all-time highs. We have sentiment that is off the chart. We have positioning that is as bullish as it has been. We have Mercury going into retrograde. We have historical instances where that has been a negative event. And then what all we need is a trigger. So what's the trigger? Well, the trigger is Trump. Literally, he got shot at a couple days before, but that actually didn't spook the markets. The markets actually were up for 2 days after. But his poll, he was surging in the polls. Biden was still the nominee. It was largely assumed that with Trump being potentially assassinated and Biden being on the decline, that Trump was very clearly in line to become the next president. And what does Trump do at the leading up to the convention? He says that Taiwan should pay for their own defense. If the United States is going to defend Taiwan against China, well, then Taiwan should be paying for it. Not only that, but the island was taking the computer chip industry away from the United States. Now, remember, this was semiconductor industry. The semiconductors were at their all-time high. Sentiment was at its all-time high. Positioning was at its all-time high. And Trump says Taiwan should be paying for their own defense and they shouldn't be taking away the computer chip industry from the United States. And he's now the presumptive, you know, winner of the presidential election. So what happens? So that he said this on the 16th and it was reported on the 17th. Guess what happened on the 17th to Taiwan Semiconductor? That's this right here. Boom. What happens to the QQQs? What happens to the NASDAQ? July 17th, boom. What does then that translate into the broad market? July 17th, boom. So the point is when markets get as stretched as they are, you don't necessarily gonna have a crash. You don't really know what's going to cause it to pull back. But when you get to that level on a number of different indicators, you just kind of know something is going to do it and you're just waiting to see what it is. So anyway, I thought that was something that's kind of interesting. You guys are welcome to take a look at some of the indicators that I talked about, to look them up through different sources that you have. I would encourage you to at least think about those things when you're looking at your portfolios. And here's the thing is, it just so happened that this time happened to be when markets are high. But I could go back and I could show you a number of those same indicators in both the COVID lows and then also the lows of 2022. And they would be the exact opposite. And so that's a good buying opportunity when things are at their lows and nobody wants them. So anyway, I thought that was kind of an interesting thing to show you guys as we kind of move forward here. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about was, you know, even though we've had this pullback in equities now, it's really hasn't been due to any crisis. It's really driven, I think, by Trump's comments about the technology and the semiconductor industry. And then that has, you know, kind of pulled the broader market with it. And the reason it hasn't been because of any kind of crisis or anything. In fact, what we've seen is a rotation from the you know, the technology stocks and some of the S&P 500 into the Russell 2000 and the Dow. Those have actually rallied over the last couple of weeks while the S&P and the technology stocks have pulled back. So it's largely just a valuation rotation that's happened for the last couple of weeks. So it hasn't even been because of any kind of a crisis at this point. Now, that doesn't mean that there couldn't be one, and it doesn't mean that we won't have further downside because of one. But I think that's one thing that's kind of important to remember. The other thing I'd say is it was fairly easy for me to put those extra hedges on a couple of weeks ago because all of those indicators were hitting. Again, it's on the one hand, it's very hard because markets are just surging. Everybody's making money and it's never comfortable going against the herd. But when you have that many indicators that are lining up, it actually kind of makes it easier to make the trade. And it becomes harder as you get pullbacks. Now, what I didn't put on here is I think many of you guys remember back in, I think it was April, and then again in May, there was two times where I did bought puts on silver. And again, not because I hate silver, not because I think that silver is a horrible investment. I actually think silver is going much higher in the years ahead. But silver at those times hit all of these same indicators. I could have shown the same charts for silver. You know, the RSI was through the roof. The stochastics were through the roof. Positioning got stretched. Sentiment was just crazy. And, you know, at that point, you know, you're going to get at least a short-term pullback. And that's what happened. But one thing that I wanted to talk about here was that it becomes harder. It actually becomes harder as these things come down. So let me just go back to this slide here really quick. I'll give you an example. Now that the market has pulled back, now that relative strength is kind of in the middle ground, now the stochastics are clear down here, it actually becomes harder what to do because, you know, you could certainly say that we're going to have more downside, but we're not as overbought as we used to be either. If I look at the S&P 500, and let me see, if we look at the NASDAQ, right? I mean, look how far down the stochastics have come. Look how far down the relative strength has come. It wouldn't surprise me now if we may get a little bit more downside, but then I think we would probably be due for at least a short-term bounce before then potentially rolling over more. But again, markets don't go in straight lines. This is just a way to use some of these indicators to kind of get an idea of whether things will continue or whether things are due for a bounce, at least in the short term. Now, the other thing that I was going to talk about is the, again, why I say part of the reason I say it's a valuation play is because, again, we haven't had any other markets really affected. You know, rates have started to come down a little bit on the short end. We're starting to get the bull steepener. You know, a lot of people have been expecting a bear steepener, but we've actually had a kind of a bull steepener in bonds as short-term rates have started to come down because people are now expecting the Fed to cut rates in September, especially with some of the recent weakness we've had in equities. But we haven't really had a liquidity play. You know, high yield is still doing okay. The spreads haven't, you know, blown out completely. So it's not to say that we couldn't have more excitement if that kind of stuff starts to happen. But again, so far, this has really just been a valuation compression. And so it'll be really interesting to see where we go from here, especially with the markets that have rallied, like the Dow has rallied and the Russell 2000 has rallied. The other thing that I would say is, I'm just going to look at some notes here because I want to make sure I don't miss this, is, you know, you've often heard me talk about how I'm not as worried about things in the U.S. despite the overvaluations, despite the stretched sentiment. I'm just as worried about things outside the United States as I am inside the United States. And part of the reason, and you've heard me talk about this many times, is because I believe that debt matters. Now, oftentimes people will tell me the reason the U.S. is in so much trouble, the reason the U.S. cannot continue to outperform the rest of the world, is because of all of its debt. And now interest rates are higher, and there's no way that they can continue to service all of that debt with these now higher rates. And debt has consequences. And when the U.S. has to deal with its debt problem, then that will be really bad for the U.S. The problem with this analysis, actually, there's nothing wrong with that analysis in and of itself. The problem is when you think that that only applies to the United States. And again, if you do analysis in a vacuum on the United States, the only possible conclusion you can come to is that things are really bad, it can't continue, and things are going to end up really poorly, right? But the error is thinking that you can analyze the United States in a vacuum and come to a conclusion of what's going to happen, because it's a big world. And the United States is not the only one with a debt problem. The rest of the world has a debt problem as well. And they actually have, in many ways, a bigger debt problem than the United States, because they owe debt in a currency that they can't print. They owe debt in a currency that they have to go out and buy. And they have to buy that currency as it continues to get stronger versus their local currencies. And that is why a strong dollar relative to its other currencies, peers, is such a problem for the world. And the rest of the world owes just as much in dollars as the U.S. owes in dollars. The difference is the U.S. has a money printing machine for dollars and the rest of the world doesn't. And that's why, despite all of the bailouts, all of the QE, all of the money printing, all the stimulus plans since 2008, the dollar has risen 25% versus peer currencies, as far as the DXY goes. And it's up a lot more than that versus several other currencies. So think about all the things that have happened in the last 15 years, all the reasons that should have sent the dollar lower, and yet it's up 25%. It has to do with the fact that the rest of the world has a debt problem as well, and they owe debt in a currency that they don't have control over. The other thing that you got to remember is that people will often talk about now, the other problem that the U.S. has is this fiscal dominance. The United States government is spending so much, and the debt problems have gotten so big, and they're spending so much, and the budget is so big that you have this crowding out phenomenon. That the fiscal dominance of the United States is leading to a misallocation of capital, which will have negative ramifications. It will deprive certain industries of capital, and it will ultimately, you know, not go to the most efficient places, and that will end up having consequences. Well, if the United States is having troubles because of fiscal dominance, then there is no way for the rest of the world not to have problems from fiscal dominance, because the rest of the world gets their dollars from the United States. The only way the rest of the world can get dollars other than from the United States is by risking their own balance sheet and increasing loans in the euro dollar market. So it's not to say that they can't do that, but they need to have a growing economy and a strong global economy in order for them to continue doing that without negative consequences to their balance sheet. So if you are of the opinion that fiscal dominance is a problem for the United States, and it's going to have negative consequences due to the level of debts, then there is no way that you can think that the rest of the world doesn't have the same issues. Because there's basically three places that the rest of the world can get dollars from. Number one is somebody in the United States can put dollar bills in a suitcase and physically fly them out of the country. That's one way. The other way they can get dollars is they can trade with the United States. They can send their goods to the United States, and in return, the United States can send them dollars. The third way that they can get dollars is they can extend dollar credit in the euro dollar market. But that, again, that third way, that means they are risking their own balance sheet. And if the people that they loan those dollars to aren't able to give them back to them, then their balance sheet is in trouble. So again, It's no problem to think that the United States has problems. The United States has an enormous amount of problems. It's no problem to think that fiscal dominance is going to have negative ramifications for the United States. It is going to have negative ramifications for the United States. But you cannot be logically consistent and think that those problems are going to manifest in the United States and they will not also manifest themselves outside the United States in the euro dollar market. I mean, one easy place to think about this is just look at China. China's stock market has fallen dramatically. Their real estate market has fallen dramatically. They've been easing monetary policy for a while now, and they just cut rates this week because they have to continue to relieve pressure from the deflationary pressures in their banking system where all these bad loans are. So that's just one example of where that can happen. The other thing I would say is we talked about this last week. I just want to refer to this a little bit. The other way that can end up having troubles, especially as we move forward, and if Trump gets into office, and here's the thing, even if Trump doesn't get into office, in many ways, Biden has continued Trump's policies, and he hasn't really done a pivot from them economically. And if Kamala somehow beats Trump, she most likely continues Biden's policies. And the thing about both Trump and J.D. Vance, it doesn't matter whether you agree with them. It doesn't matter whether you vote with them. It doesn't matter whether or not you think they are smart, intelligent, rational people. They have touched a chord with many parts of the United States, especially those who have been beaten down economically and former manufacturing areas. And those are politically important places. So even if Vance and Trump don't get into office, I think it will be very hard for Kamala or whoever the Democrats end up getting into the White House to totally pivot away from kind of the populist rhetoric that Trump and J.D. Vance have advanced. So I think it doesn't matter really who gets in. We are now in a world that is no longer globalizing. It's actually deglobalizing. We're no longer in a world that is cooperating the way it used to. There's less cooperation today than there was. We're in a world where now we have military conflicts that are popping up in several places around the world. And so the idea that you can have this, again, this fiscal dominance and budgetary problems in the United States, and that will lead to, bad things as a result of all the debt. You can't have that in the United States and not have it outside the United States. The supply of dollars outside the United States will become an issue if Trump and Vance get in and start raising these tariffs. And I think it likely also becomes an issue even if they don't get in. So the flow of capital to the rest of the world is not as easy and as efficient as it used to be. The other last place thing I wanted to talk about, what did I say? I think we're now moving into a period. We've talked about this all year, that the second half of the year was going to be more volatile than the first half of the year. We've now gotten to a point where, the VIX has started to rise again. We've seen the rollover from the highs of equities. Now, it doesn't mean that they can't go higher, but we've started to see this rollover. We're getting into this period of time where things are going to get even crazier politically. I mean, we've already had one assassination attempt. We've had one president say he's not running. We have a vice president who is largely unheard of or unseen for the last couple of years, now becoming, the greatest thing that the Democrats have ever put forward. We'll probably have a debate between, Harris and Trump at some point. But you're going to see both sides dig in even more as we get closer to the election. And after the election, we're going to see more societal volatility or societal disruption, which probably leads to higher volatility. And, the bloom is a little bit off the rose with equities just grinding higher. So I think, I don't know for sure what's going to happen. I think we probably are most likely going to have more down inside in equities before the election. I think the Fed will very likely cut rates in September. I don't think they're going to cut rates on Wednesday. We've got a Fed meeting coming up this week, so we'll know more in a couple of days. But my guess is we're going to see more downside in equities this week coming forward. Then maybe we bounce for a couple of weeks. And then, probably start to get a lot more volatile in September and October. So, again, I would encourage people to not just look at the upside in their portfolios, make sure you have some kind of protection. Again, I'm not telling you to sell everything you own, move to Montana, you know, buy the top of a mountain and come back in 10 years. But it's certainly a time where I think you need to have some kind of protection, whether it's cash, whether it's some hedges, whether some, you know, other parts of your portfolio that would do well in adverse scenarios. And the other thing that I've said many times, and I'm going to say it again, is that as things get more charged and more heated and more crazy politically, the harder it's going to be to find people who you can reason with. So find people who you don't necessarily agree with, but you can have a normal, rational conversation with before the craziness starts, because it'll be very hard to find them when the craziness does start. In other words, build up your community of people that you can talk to and trust, because unfortunately, I think we're getting into a period where sides are going to be drawn. And, you know, once people stop talking to each other, that's when things really go sideways. So anyway, thanks for tuning in. You know, like I said at the beginning, this is kind of a new era for the show. We're going to have to kind of see how it goes, but I'm glad you guys are still here. I hope you guys stick around. Once again, want to say a big thank you to my buddy John, who did an incredible job. And I had a lot of fun with him over the last couple of years, and I'm sad to see him go, but I'm excited to see what he does next. And anyway, we'll be back next week, and we'll talk to you then. In the meantime, stay safe and hug your families.